Well, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I'm hoping that you will come to see this 2 hours every Sunday night as a kind of respite from the news. I, for one, am overwhelmed, just frankly overwhelmed by the news, 99% of it bad, 90% of it not optimistic. And so I hope to give you a little, I don't know, an oasis here. Before I introduce my first guest of the evening, a fabulous guy, J.J. Tindall, who's a poet, he's a historian, he's a tour guide, he's a lot of other things. J.J., how are you? You okay?
Yes, Rick, I'm excellent, and I appreciate the statement that you just made. I'm with you on that. I hope that we could provide a little
I'm gonna have to start with, and I know you obviously, as anybody in Chicago was, were a huge fan of John Prine.
Yes.
Yep. And John is he was an old friend of mine. I've known John forever, and he is in dire straits with the coronavirus.
Right. I thought your news would be worse. Forgive me for interrupting.
No. I think it's bound to get worse very quickly. But just in honor of John, I'd like to start our segment with a vintage John Prine song. Here he is singing "Angel from Montgomery." Songs. J.J. Tindall, you obviously know John Prine, do you not? And I may be not friends.
But I know his music. I don't know him personally.
Yeah.
But he's one of Maywood's finest, of course, and a great poet and storyteller.
Well, as are you, my friend. It's been a long time since I've had you on the radio. But what is intriguing, you did for some years, you were the official poet of the Beachwood Reporter. How many years would you do that, J.J.?
We ended up, Rick, we have an archive that covers 12 years.
Wow.
It started in 2007, yeah.
Wow.
And it's all right there.
And how did you first start doing that?
I remember seeing Steve Rhodes, the editor and publisher of the Beachwood Reporter, and one evening he was on Chicago Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching the panel And I just spontaneously sent in a poem about Soldier Field, the renovated Soldier Field. And it was something along the lines of, we should put circus animals in there, lions and tigers, and feed them aldermen. Okay, kind of a cheap joke.
Not that cheap. I like it.
But I will have you know this, over the course of time, and now this might not be the most popular point of view, but I'm starting to sort of appreciate the solution that resulted in what we see there now. I'm a little more tolerant, a little more understanding of what had to happen. The original Soldier Field was a landmark.
Yeah.
And so that couldn't be torn down, but it needed to be repaired. I know it seems silly. The riff on the tour was, it looks like a Martian spaceship landed in a Roman Colosseum.
Right.
But that's a couple of examples of buildings or structures that I have changed my tune about. But that was the start, and Steve said, hey, man, I like this. He included it in his daily papers column and said, bring it on, man, if you want to keep sending stuff, and if I like it, I'll post it. And
now, was there any with Steve? I know Steve pretty well, and I am in many ways, and I want to ask you too. I am his fortitude being able to run that site on what is basically a shoestring amazes me. I mean, it amazes me, his dedication to it. And he worked for the Tribune for a while. He's a very talented reporter. But the fact that he's kept going all this time is pretty amazing, don't you think?
He's passionate, and he's dedicated, and he has a point of view. Oh, boy, does he have a point of view.
Yes, he does.
And I think it's an important element of the general public conversation about our city and our politics and our media. And that's who he is and what he does. It's not easy.
No kidding. We got to take a break, and I'm going to keep you on the whole hour, J.J. Tyndall.
All right.
Well, you know, it's been a long time.
Or as Rodney Bingenheimer would say, out of sight. I was just watching a movie on him, sorry.
No, that's okay. That's what this show's about. It's to get people a little bit distracted from the clouds that hang over this planet.
I'm all about that.
Yeah, tonight. No kidding. We'll take a little break and come back, and now we're going to talk something else, a recent thing that has attracted your interest is the fact that you have been for many years a tour guide for the boating companies that traverse the river, and have now sort of expanded that to generally address many of the unbelievably outrageous falsehoods that tourists discover when they come to Chicago. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Before he became a world-renowned poet, J.J. Tyndall was a lot of things. He was a musician, recording artist. He started giving tours on the Chicago River. J.J., remind me and some of your fans, because I do hear from your fans all the time whenever I mention you in print. You moved to Chicago in, like, 1986 and worked... Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I moved here with a group of friends in 1986. We were all musicians originally working in the Bloomington Normal. We all went to Illinois State. And then when it was time to graduate and leave, pretty much en masse, we moved into Chicago. And it all centered around rehearsal space.
Right.
Our leader found, a loft on the near south side that we could use as rehearsal space if we worked at the bus garage that was also there. That was the deal. So I became a tour guide in the loop on the double decker buses.
That's a wonderfully interesting career path. That's fascinating. Fascinating.
I didn't mean for it at the time to be a career. It was like a summer job.
Yeah, and right, over sure. Time, sure.
Right? Just got into it. Because it's a story. It's another instance of being a storyteller, and that's something I'm interested in.
Well, that's something you've always been interested in. You have, though, an undying respect for the truth in storytelling. I have been going on river tours for as long as you've been alive, and have
all
ever
39
been
39 years.
Pardon me?
All 39 years?
Yeah.
Oh, that was awful. I'm sorry.
Stop it. And the whole notion that people have been getting, it offends you a bit, JJ, that people are fed, many people, not all of them, there's some good tour operators, but many of them are fed the same old, you know, hoary cliches about, you know, the Mrs. O'Leary's cow and every other cliche. This personally offends you, does it not?
It began to over time, absolutely, because I think the truth is more interesting.
Yeah.
And I can have a sense of humor about Mrs. O'Leary's cow, and I think most people get it. But here's something that surprised me that kind of started this process. Seriously, more people, at least initially, believe that Mrs. O'Leary's cow started the fire than believe that we reversed the river. That the river reversal is somehow got to be legend. It's not conceivable. That's ridiculous. The cow, makes sense.
It's also too much science fiction. People can't wrap their heads around, wait a minute, what do you mean you reverse the river? It's much more easy to grasp a cow kicking over a peg leg Sullivan kicking over a lantern and doing that. When you started doing the tours with that kind of with your inimitable enthusiasm, you must have begun to fall in a greater, deeper appreciation for the city itself, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I moved here in 1986, I grew up in Naperville.
Mm-hmm.
We would drive down to Bazaar Bazaar in Old Town. We'd go to the record stores. We'd go to concerts, often using Metra. But to talk about really knowing much about the history and certainly about the architecture, at first, I didn't know very much. But over time, it just gets more rich, more alluring, and more, sometimes it's astounding. For example, reversing the river. And then you have to, with that one in particular, other than giving people a lesson in physics and gravity,
yeah,
you have to find a way to make it elegant and fit into a 2 or 3 minute story, which can be difficult. It's a challenge.
Have you ever, I've never asked you this, have you ever thought to take your stories as they are presented on board ship, and turn that into it? Because in essence, J.J. Tyndall, what you're doing is giving a one-man theatrical presentation, I think.
Thank you, Rick. I'm glad that you appreciate it. 75 minutes of just J.J.
Yeah.
You know, it's just me, and you can't take... There's only one place where you can take five now, which is on the north branch of the river, because the people at Kinsey Square complain about the noise.
Yeah.
So you do get a break there, but it's a one-man show 3 to 5 times a day, and that's me and 3 people or 300 people. Yeah, it's a performance.
And you enjoy it. But what about, I mean, I'm dead serious about expanding that somehow into a, you know, especially in the wintertime, into a theatrical venue, because I think it would be fascinating.
Well, I think that's very kind of you. What I've been thinking more about, but would be part of the process, I'm doing a lot more writing about and of my vision and my interpretation, and I suppose it could lead to something like that, but at least I've started writing much more about what I've been talking about. Especially now, not just the winter, but nobody's working right now, and it doesn't look like we're going to be too soon.
Yeah. How are you? I hate to, you know, touch the bad topic, but how are you coping? How are you able to cope with staying indoors? What are you reading? What are you doing? What are you lamenting?
Right.
writing?
Well, most of the day getting ready for us, Rick. I was watching the American Experience, Chicago City of the Century, and I just finished listening to Ed Burke tell the Peg Leg O'Sullivan story. But I'm reading a biography of Frank Lloyd Wright because he's my next subject matter. I am joining up with my friend and colleague Hillary Marzek at Inside Chicago Walking Tours.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a really exciting new take on Frank Lloyd Wright walking tours here in Oak Park. So that I'm reading. Also, Joel Selvin has written a book called Fare Thee Well about the Grateful Dead after Jerry Garcia. And I love that sort of thing as a musician. So that's what I've been reading before I watched the movie today.
Have you, you've also sort of formed a new sort of feature for Beachwood, for the Beachwood Reporter. It's a Confessions of a Chicago Tour Guide. So far, only parts one and two, is that right?
There's a third about Ray Kroc and Naperville's Prince's Castle. Very quickly.
Sure. No, you don't have to be quick. We are on for the whole hour.
Okay. I realized recently that I live near where he grew up.
Really?
And after the movie The Founder came out, remember The Founder?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right? Michael. And you see Michael Keaton as Ray Kroc at the Prince's Castle office in the LaSalle Wacker building, which I didn't know about. So that becomes a neat, new, refreshing story that part of my tour. So I started digging in and realized that now that most of us know about Ray Kroc and Dick and Mac McDonald, you might think, wow, Kroc really sunk his teeth into Dick and Mac. Well, it turns out he sharpened his teeth before those two on Walter Friedhagen and Earl Prince from Naperville, proprietors of Prince Castle ice cream and hamburger regional chain. Actually, was just here in the suburbs.
Oh, interesting.
So, Kroc, the multi-mixer that is featured in the movie that was so crisp, invented by Earl Prince of Naperville, Illinois.
That's
not mentioned in the movie.
No, not at all. Also not mentioned in the movie is I happen to know later in life a guy named... Here's a great story for you, JJ, that...
Well, you're a pretty good storyteller, too, my friend.
Well,
sorry,
thank you.
Folks.
But I'm so... At one point, a young man has decided to go off and start a public relations firm, a guy named Al Golan. And he gets an office in some building, I think on Wacker downtown. And his first day in his office, a man comes in and says, what do you do? And then Al Golan says, well, I'm in public relations. And the other man says, well, do you have any clients yet? And the man says, no, I don't. I don't have any clients yet. He goes, well, how'd you like to work for me? And Al Golan says, well, who are you?
Who the hell are you?
Ray Kroc.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when was this?
It had to be, you know, early 50s, whenever. It's eminently provable, man. Isn't that a great story? That is one of the luckiest. Some guy comes in your office and says, yes, work for me. I'm about to
build the world's largest restaurant company that is still headquartered in Chicago, right off Old 66.
Yeah, no kidding. What? Let's go back to this other thing that intrigues me a lot. Are these confessions of a Chicago tour guide. The first one, you sort of take apart some of the absolute crazy cliches. And
especially the one that I think that rankles me the most I addressed in that first issue.
Which one?
The Civic Opera House.
Oh, my God. Go
can
ahead.
We go there?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
It started to get to me on my river shifts, three or four times a day, going by there, and the acoustics of those two Art Deco buildings, the Riverside Plaza, I still call it Riverside Plaza, and the Opera House. So that you can hear the lies from the other tour guides talking about it was designed by Samuel Insull to be a throne that's facing with its back towards New York because he had a grudge. And he also had a mistress who was an opera singer.
Yeah.
And the movie Citizen Kane is based on
Marion
Samuel
Davies,
Insull and
man.
His mistress.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, right. It is nonsense. More or less. There's just a kernel of truth. Insull was part of the design of that building.
Yep.
It's not a most Art Deco buildings in the Loop are thrones because that's an element, a critical recurring element of Art Deco architecture.
Yep.
Well, Insull had a wife who was an actress. She was a little older. She was at the end of her career. And the screenwriter for Citizen Kane, I think it's Howard Mankiewicz, admitted that he made that whole thing up while he was passed out drunk in the middle of giving Mrs. Insull a bad review.
Jesus, fantastic.
And I give props to my colleague, Adam Seltzer, who dug out the documentary evidence. The credible documentary evidence that it's a bunch of hooey, but people love it. And if you don't tell that story, they get snippy.
Yeah, that's so funny. When we come back, we got to take a little commercial break, but when we come back, I want to talk to you about the fact that what is it that is so appealing about idiotic historical stories? Like, oh my God, there, look at the water tower, the only thing to survive the great Chicago fire. I'm on the with J.J. Dindal for this, the rest of this hour, and we're talking about all manner of stuff. JJ, do you have a website? You don't, do you?
Not of my own. I've got a poetry page on Facebook. I've got the archive at the Beachwood.
Yeah.
I've got music at Spotify, but not a central place right now.
Good. Well, people can find you.
Google JJ Dindal.
JJ Dindal. We'll be back in a few minutes and carry on about Chicago history. Welcome back. I am reading from a very recent Beachwood Reporter column by J.J. Tyndall, Confessions of a Tour Guide, Part 1. He writes that too many tour companies pander to the market, purposefully telling tall tales because they're popular. J.J., are they popular because they've been repeated so many times? Is that, you know, sort of like the, you know, the millions of legendary tales that surround the billy goat, for God's sake. Half of them are crazy and wrong, but
and half of them are true.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's the best part. That's the best part.
Right.
So what is it? Is another thing about it is people who come to Chicago as tourists like to go back and say, hey, you should take this tour guide. You wouldn't believe, you know, there's one building there that survived the Chicago fire, and there's one building that Al Capone used to use was a, you know, for a
speakeasy.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
and they get into the fabric of the city, and no one, I guess, really wants to be the myth buster. But I think you're doing a great job here with doing that very thing. I think
in this instance, I guess what I would say is the truth is cooler.
Totally.
I don't know how else to put it.
No, totally. Go ahead. Give me an example, for instance.
Al Capone never partied in the dome of what I call the old jeweler's building. Because I get that question. Here's the legend, and it's very specific. He had a Stutz Bearcat that he would drive into the car elevator and go up to the dome during Prohibition and party. Now, there are some elements. There are some elements of truth. There was a car elevator in the jeweler's building, so that jewelers could drive in and go up to their floor in their car and not have to take their valuables out on the street. I dig that.
Right.
That's true.
Sure.
It's not something that Al Capone put in so he could go party. There wasn't a speakeasy there. Yeah. There was a legal nightclub that was established, I believe, in 1937, mm-hmm. which was, of course, when liquor was legal.
And he was long gone.
He was in, yeah, he, yes, exactly. And when it was still, when Prohibition was still in effect,
mm-hmm.
He was in prison by the time there was really anything going on.
Yeah.
drinking wise at the old jeweler's building. So when you really dig in, it all falls apart. But Rick, I think it's novelty and mm-hmm. romance mm-hmm. and drama.
Yeah. Yeah. You become, I don't know if you were great friends of his before, but you have become a good friend with a friend of mine, a guy you admire a great deal, John Binder, who you call. You respect John Binder, do you not?
I think he is the definitive outfit/mob source or guide or teacher in our fair city. Mm. He's the real deal. He does the original research, primary research.
Yep.
And I took a 2-hour tour with him, and I was just thoroughly infotained, such that I am going to stay infotained.
You two should do something together. Have you ever thought of that?
Well, he's got, his expertise is in a different area, but I'd love to work with John Binder.
Yeah,
I think he's the kind of guy that is going to give it to you straight, and in that sense, it's going to be better than if somebody who doesn't know the truth but knows the legends that are sometimes perhaps more entertaining. I don't know.
No, I could not agree more. Binder's done a lot of. He's an academic. Don't get me wrong, but he's done a lot of writing. Previous books are The Chicago Outfit, the Circadia book.
I've got the Outfit book, and if you want the answers, it's just right there.
Yeah.
That's the man you go to.
Yep.
And you also, Rick, as you say about a performance, well, we were both teachers. I did teaching in a lot of different levels, including the college level where I tried to teach. I did teach essay writing and tried to get my students into learning what a credible source was.
Oh, wow.
And I would call John Binder credible. It was like pulling teeth to get.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was like that at that age, too.
But, you know, one thing that troubles me, and troubles me for bright, intelligent people like you, is the sort of easy access to so-called facts via Google and other internet kinds of things that removes, you know, the deep research that used to be the foundation of some of the great Chicago history books, you know, when people would have to dig through old files and old archives and not just be able to, you know, Google Al Capone's secret garage
vault,
elevator,
right?
You know,
I love the Bill Burr gag where he says, yeah, I just went to IamRight.com and it says it's all about IamRight.com, and it doesn't have to be that way, but it's easier that way.
Now, do you, because of that, JJ, do you ever get in hassles with people on your tours?
Yes.
Do
Before you finish the question, I can just go yes.
Go ahead. Tell me about some of that.
Well, people, look, Trump Tower's on the tour.
Mm-hmm.
That is a powder keg unless you know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And I know how to deal with it. 7 years, 8 years, no one has ever complained to me about the way I treat the building and the president, because I just deal with facts as they're related to the building. And so I do okay, but it's a powder keg, and other guides have often gotten into trouble.
Yeah.
Because they don't do it right.
Well, you know, it's tempting, I suppose, for some.
It's not professional to politicize it.
Yeah, well,
There's plenty that you can say about that gorgeous building
mm-hmm.
by Adam Smith, formerly of Adrian Smith.
Adrian Smith, yeah.
formerly, see, I was worried that I was going to do that.
What?
Adrian Smith, Skidmore yeah. Owings Mill. It's a beautiful and, to me, a very definitive building of its kind. It's got a lot of novelty. It's got a lot of interest where that you can talk about it enough and keep it relevant to the facts and to architecture. And if you can do that, you're fine.
Talk to me about, you mentioned earlier, J.D., were you talking about Frank Lloyd Wright, or were you talking about Sullivan, Louis Sullivan?
I think I was talking about Wright because he's my next focus.
But
they both go together. They work together.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Of course, Wright would tell you he did it all.
Yes, he would. Yes, he absolutely would. How focus for what? What are your plans? What are you thinking of doing with him?
Well, as I say, my colleague Hillary Marzek and I have an idea about presenting Frank Lloyd Wright in his time in context, that he just didn't spring out of Zeus's head, for example. That the first early Frank Lloyd Wright houses in Oak Park are not recognizable. He didn't just come out of nowhere. He had peers. Mm. He had influences. He was influenced by the art movements of his time. And so too many tours and tour guides throw data, trivia, but there's no context, there's no story, there's no narrative, and there's no larger picture. I think it's got to be a story, and that's what we're working on. We haven't figured it all out yet, but we're really excited because Hillary and I both have been doing this a long time. Very similar views, as we have discussed, about truth being the most interesting thing, and to not overwhelm people with facts, but try to bring them in, not push them away, and suggest that, well, you have to be an expert like me to really get this.
Right, right.
You want to be able to go, you can figure this out too. Here's what to look for.
Wow.
That's our thing.
That's a nice way of teaching. You're a born teacher. We got to take a last little break and can keep you on for another 10 minutes or so. But this has been fascinating. Again, you can go find, you can easily find him. You find him at JJ.
If you Google me, dude, or I'm sorry, if you Google JJ Tindall, on the first two pages, you're going to pretty much find the range of my work.
Yeah, and it's a lot. I like your poetry archive too, is great, and you'll read some other things that he's done for the Beachwood Reporter, and you'll get introduced to the Beachwood Reporter itself. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes left with JJ Tindall, and we are lucky to be joined on the phone by our mutual pal, John Binder. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, gentlemen, how you doing?
Good, good, good.
Hey, John.
I guess you must have, even without a radio, must have heard the two of us praising you like crazy. Tell me about your relationship with JJ. I mean, he is a like-minded guy, is he not, John?
Yeah. Yeah, I've known JJ for a bit. He has been on, I think, at least one of the tours I do. He's very interested in organized crime history and stuff. And then he recently interviewed me for an article, and I believe an article or two articles, whatever, ran in the Beachwood Reporter, right?
Right, right, right.
Yes.
And he also, I mean, he has great respect for you, and he did one in light of the recent strange massaging of history called The Irishman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Obviously, we know that Hollywood will take license, but sometimes they're passing things off by. They're actually making a movie based upon a book. The book is sort of passing itself off as reality. The movie doesn't question the book, so the whole thing is being vended to us as this is the true story, and that's different than a couple of fiction guys writing a script.
Yeah, exactly. And it's
well,
also it's also vastly different than a couple of guys writing the truth too.
Yeah, even more so.
Yeah, really, John. What are you working on these days?
Right now, I'm just doing some stuff, getting back on some old projects related to photo identification. So what I had mentioned regarding The Irishman, that actually is from something I published back in 2007, and then became timely because the Irishman really picks up on this myth that the outfit elected Jack Kennedy president in 1960.
Yeah, talk about that. That's a real, both of you guys talk about that. That was a, that's a real tricky, not to me, but tricky to many so-called historians and or keepers of a phony flame. Talk to me about that 60 election and, you know, Sam Giancana and Mayor Daley and blah, blah, blah.
I guess I can go ahead. I mean, there's two different, at minimum, two different things here. One is there's longstanding assertions that Mayor Daley and the Chicago Democratic machine delivered for JFK. Like, you know, they really pulled out all the stops to get the vote out. Okay, that could well be. I don't have anything to really say about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one, and this starts to get really blown up in the 1990s by some people who don't have a lot of credibility, the other assertion is that, oh, the outfit, you know, largely by itself, nothing to do with you know, the Cook County Democratic machine, that they got out the vote around Chicago and they got out the union voters nationally for JFK as part of a bargain. They elect JFK president and the Kennedy administration will back off on organized crime.
Yeah. And what do you guys believe?
JJ, I believe what John says.
Oh, my God. I like you better and better every second, JJ. I look at you, sir. I actually went and did this test work on this, and then the results were published in an article in an academic journal, Public Choice, in 2007. At the end of the day, if there's any truth to these stories, then you should see it in the voting patterns. And
yeah,
there's no statistical evidence that the outfit delivered the vote around Chicagoland in the areas where they had the ability to do so because they controlled, you know, the ward organization, or that union voters nationally voted unusually heavily for JFK. So it's a great conspiracy theory story. Those things are always very sexy to the ear, or often sexy to the ear, but there's no evidence that it happened.
Now, see, there's my man talking about the data. He dug in, and he's right. It should be reflected in the numbers, and it's not. But sexy is the word, and the other idea I had, and I think John may or may not agree, but magic knowledge. I know something that you don't know. Everybody thinks this, that it was Mayor Daley, but it was really the mob. And then for a month or six, you could sell a book and you get some attention.
Yes,
yeah. You're special.
Yeah.
You know something that someone else doesn't know or that no one else knows.
Sensationalism sells books like crazy nowadays, meaning the last several decades at minimum. Even the publishers are quick to run with it without, you know, doing much fact-checking. And so it's open season for creating conspiracy theories because some members of the public are quick to buy into them and buy the books and on and on and on.
Well, there does seem to be an almost, sadly, limitless market for those kinds of books with, you know, spurious factual background. It's not so much a mystery to me. I get it, but I can't understand why publishers keep publishing it.
Well, John, if you go ahead one second, I find that the idea of randomness and luck and bad luck is frightening. The conspiracy theorist is looking for control and an explanation. And somehow it's more comforting that it was all planned rather than, well, it's a crazy world and you never know. My uncle worked as a career engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers, and he used to constantly say, hey, man, we're not good enough to do that. You know, we did again and again and again. The government is criticized for being inept, except they killed JFK. They took down the World Trade Center, and nobody knows. There's no evidence.
Because it's a conspiracy, they cover it. And just like all those NATO bases that secretly used to be inside the United States, they've covered all those up.
Right. When you used to be at Diversey in the lakefront.
The Nike silos.
Yeah. Remember that?
Yep.
I hope you guys do get to work on something together, because I respect both of you so much for your, not just for your lively interest in history, but for your diligent awareness of the fact that sometimes the facts are more entertaining than the phony history. I hope there's something you guys can do together, and I hope that we come out of this whole nightmare sooner than later.
I think you're planting a seed that is very interesting, and I agree. And I think that there might be something to that, Rick Kogan. We appreciate your support, sir.
Oh, you just let me know when, and I'll write a piece for the Tribune about it.
Hopefully, perhaps, John and I can come join you at the studio.
That would be great. You know, I'm very grateful for you guys doing this over the telephone, but
Oh, I think it was the better idea, Rick. I was kind of like, yes, I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah, well, it wasn't my idea. I'm kind of devil may care, but it is the way of the world currently, and you guys are just too talented and too much fun.
Could we listen to you talk about us for another hour?
Sure.
Terrific.
I can ramble on.
I'm enjoying every minute of it.
I can ramble.
You're so insightful, Rick. I don't know where you got this wisdom.
from his dad.
Yeah, that's part of the reason. Yeah, my father gave it to me. Gentlemen, you take care of yourselves.
And stay
inside and stay healthy. And
someday, Rick, we can get back to Dr. Nightlife.
Yes, anytime.
Thanks for having us, man.
My pleasure, you guys. Thank you very, very much. And this is J.J. Tyndall. I'm going to spell for J.J. initials, then Tyndall, T-I-N-D-A-L-L. And John Binder is pretty easy to find, too. You can just Google Mr. Binder, and you'll get it's a good time to order their books too, and read what is available about them online to warm yourself on these chilly and dangerous nights. So, fellas, thanks a million. I really appreciate it. They're gone. They abandoned me. No, those are good guys, and I do recommend John Binder's literally the definitive history of beer in Chicago. And JJ, I guess if you couldn't tell, JJ's a sort of lively person himself. We will be back after the news with Jennifer Bosnos, an old dear friend of mine who runs Call of the Wild School for Dogs. And I want to talk to Jen about one of the things I didn't realize, should have, that I don't know how this rampaging disease is affecting the lives of animals. Understandably, the news is covering mostly human beings, but I want to know what, and she's the expert, she runs Call of the Wild School for Dogs, and we'll talk to her about what people can do, again, too, if you're cooped up and can only go out and, you know, walk your dog for a half hour or something. Is that good? Is that healthy? Should you walk your dog? What should you do? I don't know. And Jen will know, that is for sure. So we'll take a little break, get some news, and come back with Jennifer Bosnos. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. When this entire coronavirus thing started, long after it started, because we were not made aware of it, frankly, soon enough, I began to worry about animals, specifically dogs, and how this thing might affect animals, because we have animals and we love animals, and I decided the person I would call to explore this and to see what troubles may exist is my dear old friend Jennifer Bosnos, who runs Call of the Wild School for Dogs. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, Ricky.
Am I, of course, you know, people dying is going to have the priority anywhere, but I did start to worry about the animal world. Can you enlighten me? Am I just being, you know, typically alarmist about all this or no?
Well, I'm not quite sure exactly what you're worried about. Are you worried that the dogs might be able to catch the coronavirus
yes.
from people?
Yeah.
I don't think there's any evidence of that. I'm not a medical professional.
Yeah.
But I think that there was more of a concern that if an infected human sneezed or coughed on a dog and another human touched that dog where the infected person coughed
wow,
or sneezed,
sure, sure.
that the dogs could unwittingly transmit the virus, you know, because we're so in love with our dogs, as you well know.
Yes, I do.
That there's a lot of, you know, hugging and kissing and touching of the dogs, and other people might touch and kiss and hug your dog, and so there was a little bit of concern about that. It's since been discovered that fur is a porous it's porous, and so it's a poor transmitter of the virus. That's not to say that you shouldn't be careful.
Right, right.
But I think the when you're talking about dying, if anything, the dogs might be dying of boredom because so many of the dogs in Chicago go to daycare.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
In the morning when their owners get ready to go to work, you know, most of the dogs that I know are also getting ready to go to school.
Right, right.
A lot of the owners would affectionately call going to daycare, you know, we're going to go to school now.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these dogs are benched. And
I have to believe, Jen, that the dogs, especially at a place like a Call of the Wild School for Dogs, are used to that. They look forward to this. This is part of their life now. And when that kind of routine is shattered, it is an adjustment that must be difficult to make.
Well, I think it's also an adjustment that's difficult for the humans to make.
Right.
Because, you know, so many of our really wonderful clients are busy professionals. And so, you know, in the morning, mom and dad go off to work, the dog goes to daycare, and the kids go to school.
Yeah.
And now mom and dad are home, the kids are home, and the dog is home.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a period of adjustment where everybody's kind of bumping into each other and the dogs, because they're used to so much activity during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's bad weather, you know, they're getting their exercise at daycare and at school. And if parents are working and the kids are e-schooling,
yeah,
that kind of leaves the dog without its exercise routine. Now, we're also finding out, you know, from talking to our clients and other dog owners in the city, that the dogs are what the humans are looking to relieve the boredom of quarantine.
Yeah.
So I think there's kind of two extremes going on. One where the routine and the exercise and the social stimulation that dogs are used to from their daycare is being replaced by kind of a quiet home life where the dogs aren't the center of attention as they are in daycare, or the reverse is true, where the humans are kind of putting everything into the dogs.
Yeah,
you know, they're getting walked 25 times a day. They're getting exercised. I was speaking to a colleague, one of our trainers at Call the Wild, Jasmine Haldane, earlier tonight, and she was saying that one of her dogs isn't sleeping as much because during a routine day at school, her dog would have some nap time in its crate, where yeah. now it's home, just following her from room to room, room to room, room to room, and and not getting any rest at all.
You obviously, although you you did comply with Commander Pritzker's shelter-in-place directive and closed on March 21, you obviously are open. You must be getting, I don't want to make light of it, you must be getting some interesting, if not panic calls, some kind of calls like, Jennifer, what should I do? The dog learned to open the refrigerator and is drinking a beer or something. Are you? I mean, people, because many people aren't there for the doggy daycare and they don't really know what the routine is. So are you getting called upon to consult on specific problems that have coming up?
Well, for us at Call of the Wild, the reverse is true because, you know, we're a school first and we're a tight-knit family with our staff and our clients. And we contacted our clients right away when we chose to comply with the governor's order. And we have a great respect for the governor. He's a dog lover. He's got two dogs. And we know his dogs quite well. And so our clients are very eager to do their part to help stop the spread of this virus. And so they were extremely supportive of our decision, and they're in touch with us, and we're in touch with them. Again, because, you know, we're a school with a private daycare, the dogs who come to us are have a lot of behavioral skills.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
And so do their owners, because our clients are quite serious students. So
sure.
They're faring well during this challenging time. We're also keeping pace with what other schools are doing, and we're offering virtual classes and private lessons. And Ricky, as you know, I'm no technology genius. So in a couple of days, you know, I've had to come up to speed with Zoom and learning how to give lessons online and give classes online, and our classes go live tomorrow night. So we're going to keep our dogs in training as much as we possibly can.
You say on your website, I think, and no offense, sweetie, relatively optimistically, that the plan was to reopen on Monday, April 13th. Are you sticking by that, or you'd expect that to change?
You know, we're going to take our lead from what the governor suggests that we do.
Mm-hmm.
We're a tight-knit family with our staff, and we will meet as a group to determine if we can keep our staff safe.
Yeah.
We've come up with adjustments in our system to create a safe separation for clients and staff, but because we work so closely with one another, taking care of the dogs, we need to make sure that our staff is safe when we have the dogs back in our care. So that's our hope. But again, we're going to do what's right for our city and for our community.
Yeah, that sounds great. Hang on a couple minutes, Jen. Let's take a commercial break, and I have some more questions. I'm talking to Jennifer Bosnos, the founder and president and lead trainer of Call of the Wild, a school for dogs, callofthewildschool.com. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Welcome back. I'm spending a few minutes with my dear friend Jennifer Bosnos talking about the COVID-19 coronavirus as it relates to specifically dogs. And so far, it seems there's cause for a bit of optimism in this whole thing. But Jen, one of the things that is unnerving to me is I'm already hearing these kind of horror stories about people who haven't been in the same apartment with their children for the last 3 years alone and are going nuts. Is there a kind of cabin fever that can strike animals too?
Well, yeah, I think so, especially if they're used to having an outlet for their energy.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many of the dogs in our city, I remember when I was a kid, Ricky, and we would go downtown from the suburbs and visit friends in the city, and they all had the same kind of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
They were very small. They lived in apartments, and they were really suitable for urban life.
Yeah.
And then you go back to the suburbs and have your bigger dogs because you had a yard with a fence. And now, you know, pretty much anything goes, and we're seeing every kind of breed, you know, that lives in downtown Chicago. And so some of these dogs need quite a lot of exercise. They need a lot of physical stimulation, a lot of mental stimulation. And so I think cabin fever to a dog would come out as destructive behavior around the house. You know, people often say that they need to get out of their way as their dog does the Indy 500 in their apartment. I'm sure.
Especially if one happened to have border collies as pets, yeah.
who would ever do that?
No one I know. It seems crazy. They're wonderful dogs, but to live with three or four of them in the same place would be above and beyond the call. You must also be getting, Jen, people, you know, I know you have valuable and valued and long-term clients who are calling for specific advice. Is there any kind of general advice that you could give to someone who is now, in essence, living full-time with their dog?
Yeah, what we've been talking to clients about is using their training is a way to make the best of this time. And so there are certain skills that we teach at Call of the Wild. A recall, Ricky, is when you teach a dog to come when it's called. And so we use 30-foot leashes to keep the dog safe in the park. And so if you take your dog walking on a long leash and it runs after a squirrel, that gives you the opportunity to call them to you. And so they get not only exercise and physical stimulation and fresh air, but you're also working your training. And so, you know, when you couple physical exercise with mental stimulation, you know, you get a tired dog. And what we like to say is a tired dog makes a happy owner.
Yeah. And one of the things, though, when you have, you know, owners, dog owners are very, to my mind, most of them are very sociable people. And this whole, you know, keeping one's distance of when you're out and about, there must be a almost irresistible urge to converse with your fellow dog owners. Do you recommend that, Jen, or is that probably not a good idea?
I mean, I think it's a good opportunity to, again, to practice your training, where if you see another dog owner on the sidewalk, that's a good opportunity for you, you know, to cue your dog to sit and stay, and you can maintain the appropriate social distance while you converse with the other owner. And it's a good way to rehearse your cues with your dog. What we're seeing downtown is the opposite, however, where people are fudging on the social distance with their dogs and letting their dogs greet each other on leash because so many of the parks are closed.
Yeah.
And, you know, a traditional leash is 6 feet, but if the dogs are saying hi to each other, then you've closed that distance. So,
Interesting.
It's tough on the people, and it's tough on the dogs because the dog parks are closed.
And it must be tough on the kids too. I mean, the kids who love the dogs, not as of course, as more than people do. The length of this kind of imposed what do you want to call it? This imposed schedule and this imposed unhinged condition. Could there be, if it lasts longer, I believe and I hope so much that things do reopen for you, certainly at Call the Wild, Monday, April 13th. But is there any, could there be any lingering effect if this thing goes on and on and on?
Well, you know, what we've been talking about is how similar this is to the dog flu and its effect on dog businesses in the city. So in 2015, we were slammed with the H3N2 canine influenza virus, and it closed down Chicago dog businesses. And we were fortunate enough to be established to weather that storm.
Yeah.
We were closed for 5 weeks.
Wow.
That was a rough one. But our business wasn't closed. We just didn't have dogs in the facility.
Mm.
At first, we thought, well, this will be like the dog flu, but it's very different because we are closed.
Yeah.
And so many daycares and boarding and training schools are closed. And this is when newer businesses get taken out, and it's a scary time. Mm. It's, you know, I will confess it, it is unnerving to be a small business owner.
Yeah, I'll bet.
During this time, because we don't really know what the length of this is going to be. And, you know, it's the kids who work for me and other kids who work in the dog business in our city and in other cities. It's akin to, you know, the service industry and restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tough on those of us in this kind of a business.
Wow. Jen, you are locked up with how many dogs these days? How many dogs are you with?
Well, are we counting the guard dog? Or, this is the joke. Do we count the guard dog or not count the guard dog? So I have a dog who lives with my sheep to protect them from the predators. So if we count the guard dog, I've got seven.
Okay.
Dogs.
Well, honey, you take care of your dogs, and you take care of your sweet self, and you take care of anybody who wants to call to ask questions. Feel free to do so, maybe not right at this moment, maybe tomorrow, at 773-539-1088, or just email info@callofthewildschool.com. Jen, you've built an incredible business, and I hope it continues to thrive, and I hope you get through this this crisis without damaging any of those fine people with whom you work. Okay, honey?
Ricky, thank you for everything, and you take care of your sweet self.
Okay, sweetie. We'll take a little break, and we will come back and hear from the one and only Tony Fitzpatrick. Welcome back to the last segment of After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. For the last couple, nah, not the last couple of weeks, last week, my friend, the artist, bon vivant, actor, playwright, director, everything, offered to read a little something that he'd written on his Facebook page. And I thought, I was very, very terribly, terribly moved by it. It was about his wandering through Humboldt Park and observing the birds that sort of could be heard in light of all the quiet that we have now. Our mutual friend Neil Steinberg used part of that in a column that he writes for the Sun-Times. And Tony said again, he offered today, frankly, you want me to read something? And because I find Tony Fitzpatrick and his writing irresistible, I said, well, sure, Tony. So, Tony, welcome back to the show.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy. Doing? Hey, how was your, they took some teeth out last week, didn't they?
Man, they took three of them out. They took a badly messed up tooth and two fake teeth out. A great dentist named Joe Thornhill and an equally great oral surgeon named Tom Snyder. And they did, I'm a heart patient. So
yeah, I know. Yeah.
They're very, I mean, the one tooth was kind of infected and stuff. So it was like, they got to come out. I mean, this is probably the worst possible time to have to go have medical help. But
you would think
they made it easy and they made it painless. You know, it was sore afterwards, but
yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah, I came through it. You know,
well, I was very, very grateful to because I love your writing. I've loved your writing wherever it has appeared, whether on stage, in between the covers of a book. And the funny thing is, you said, "What about Rick? You want to hear something about Manny's?" And the funny thing is, Kate and I had just gotten food from Manny's like 2 days before.
Both of you can survive on one sandwich for like a week.
That's right. Well, especially Kate. Yeah, especially Kate.
Yeah, I mean, they throw in the dill pickle and the latke, maybe a week and a half.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right. But I was charmed.
I've been going there forever. I can't eat there anymore because I'm a heart patient.
It's not, it's not the best heart healthy kind of place. But you capture, Tony, and I hope you'll read the whole piece for us. You really capture what that place means and what makes it a unique Chicago institution. So if you're if you're ready,
but, every politician, when they're about to announce their candidacy,
yeah,
very often they do it from Manny's.
I know.
You know, it's a city hall joint. It is, I'll just read it and you'll
thank you.
See what I mean.
Thank you.
You go through the cafeteria line at Manny's and you marvel. Brisket, corned beef, and pastrami. Sandwiches as big as your head and as garlicky as a Greek waiter. A heart attack on a plate accompanied by a huge salty dill pickle and a potato latke. You yuck it up with the sandwich guy and he enhances your pile of meat even more. You can eat here. Meaty stuff. This is the kind of meal you want before they execute you. The kind of sandwich you eat with a friend and then take the other half home for dinner and breakfast the next day and maybe lunch as well. Look around. There are city hall creatures here. Cops, aldermen, streets and sand guys with yellow neon vests and meter maids shoveling down slices of pie. There are deals being cut, bonds being haggled over, ticket quotas pondered, and the grimy business of the sidewalk being brokered. The preferred music, the ringing of the cash registered. The preferred currency, green cash money. They frown a little bit when you hand them the debit card with the chip in it. It's another pain in the ass thing the new century has grafted onto everyone. You also get the stink eye if you are one of those who blabs on your cell phone in the middle of the cafeteria line, or even at your table. People are trying to eat numbnuts. Nobody wants to hear your saga here. Take it outside, schmucko, because in here people are eating or working, or eating and working, like it's always been since Moses, pal. Got me? I see a guy slide an envelope across the table with a wry smile. Christmas card, he says. The guy across from him wordlessly puts it in the kangaroo pocket of his hoodie without so much as looking up or even saying thank you. There's a lady walking an Irish wolfhound in front of the window. The dog is excited. He can smell the meaty goodness. I also notice he's wearing dog boots and not happily. A guy from the next table comments, Jesus H. Christ, you put shoes on a dog. Look, he's trying to kick him off. He don't want to look like a jagoff in front of the other dogs. They meander by, the hound alternately fighting with his goofy boots and sniffing at the meaty air he is enshrouded by. He looks confused. There's a valet here. Big, burly guy in a Carhartt vest, quietly watching the street and reading the traffic for the slow roll of an incoming parking job. They've remodeled the joint, but it hasn't taken away any of the atmosphere in the least. And this place has atmosphere in spades. If someone asked me to take them to one place which defines the city, I might take them here. Or the Night Court at 26th in California. Or Rico Benny's for a breaded steak sandwich. Or Army and Lou's, except it's gone now. Or maybe the Great Bounty of Mexican joints in Pilsen. I'd also include Maxwell Street Polish and all the hot dog joints I loved, including the one built into the middle of a used car lot at 56th and Western. That one was my favorite. These places are adorned in the colors of urgency and exigence, rich reds, yellows, and sequential blinking lights. As a kid, I thought these places were what heaven was supposed to look like, a carnival of lights and color and food smells. There was a promise here that you would never be hungry, and the world was not merely a well-lit nowhere, but a wondrous place full of lights and magic and hope. It was a mystery that you solved every time it got dark and those lights were on. I can't eat Manny's fine sandwiches anymore. My cardiologist would blow a gasket. But I can watch as other people enjoy them. About the only thing I'm allowed to eat there anymore is Jell-O and coleslaw. Who wants to eat that? For me, the best thing to eat there was a pastrami. Damn, it was good. Greasy, salty, garlicky, and piled high on rye with a big slice of dill pickle. It might be the best thing I have ever eaten. I never could get through a whole sandwich, but my dog Chooch was very happy to share the second half with me a day later. We would be smelling very special after a Manny's bench. I always blame the dog. It is one of those places where one is happy for the lack of change. Sure, they remodeled it, but damn if they didn't preserve the character of the place. You see, it's one of those places inhabited by and for working people. There are no conversations about beer programs or sommeliers. This is belly to belly, elbow to elbow, a joint that caters to the elementally hungry. The kind of hungry you get when you operate a jackhammer or a cement mixer or hoist dumpsters for streets and sand. There's nothing delicate here. Even the city hall guys are the worker bees, the one who actually do the works their bosses take credit for on the news. It is one of those eateries that grinds out the goods and tastes like the city we claim to be, hearty and good. One of the best things to do here is just to overhear things. Not to eavesdrop, but overhear the great thoughts of people on break from work, airing out things they don't say around their bosses. Things like this. You can't get it with too much peppers. You want the sandwich you're eating not to be eating you. And then, if I had a face like his, I'd paint my ass and walk on my hands. Yeah, he's got a face for radio. I love hearing the curbside philosophies and stories, the hard-earned bits of knowledge that come from punching a clock and grinding it out 40 hours at a time and wondering what the hell it's all for. The American horse sense of people who built this city. This is a school nobody ever tells you about. The native intelligence that comes from being a citizen. The act of faith that working people carry out every day that keeps this city lurching along. One time I was there years ago and I overheard this gem. My boss laid it out for me like I was a freaking six-year-old. He says, it don't have a damn thing to do with luck, pal, but it's got everything to do with chance. Which for some reason makes sense to me each day that I live.
That's really a lovely piece of writing, Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, sir.
I'm so sorry you can't have the food that you once loved.
I sense
your affection for it in your words, I'll tell you that.
Oh my God. Every time I would go to Manny's,
yeah,
I would get that. I would either get the brisket or the pastrami.
Sure.
And the pastrami you could eat for like 2 days. Of course, nobody wanted to be near you 2 days after that.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it was a special experience. But I love just the intersection of Chicagoans. Yeah. I mean, every single class of people inhabited that place. Everything from aldermen to cops to the criminal courts guys.
Sure, sure.
And you heard the stories of this city, you know, and one microcosm.
Yeah, I hope those places...
In this crucible, yeah, you know, I mean, it's places, incredible.
I hope those places don't wind up vanishing in the light of all this nonsense.
And yeah, I nonsense mean, this pain. Week was odd.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You and me are used to going to work every day, and this is... this has been very strange.
Oh, very strange.
I turned my wife's beautiful dining room table into a makeshift studio.
Yeah.
And she is so happy about that.
Oh, I'm sure.
But
are Max and Gabby, are the kids home?
Yeah, the kids are home.
Oh, good.
They're home.
Good.
I mean, I want them close while all this is going on. I mean, this is...
Yeah.
It's got very real in the last week.
And I think it's going to get even more real in the next week, which is gives me the chills.
I hate to say that, but yeah, you're right. And then, you know, the news this evening that our friend John Prine is desperately ill.
Yeah. He's a great man.
I'm not ready for a world without John Prine, so here's hoping he rallies in a big way.
So stay tuned. After this commercial, I'm going to play one of the most haunting John Prine songs you will ever hear. Tony, thank you so much. Love to everybody, okay?
Hey, man. Love to you. Love to Katie, everyone. You know, thank you for having me. And,
anytime, pal.
It's been a joy.
Anytime.
Take care, pal.
Okay. We'll take a little commercial break, and then we will, as Tony mentioned, John Prine, arguably the greatest songwriter to ever come out of Chicago. There are people who might argue that, but I don't know many of them. I'll tell you right now, I don't know many of them. So we will end this show after a commercial break, and then we will hear a song, and then I will say goodbye. Welcome back. As you've been hearing, not only from myself, but from others at this station, John Prine, the arguably the greatest songwriter in the history of the Chicago folk music scene, is suffering badly and perhaps fatally from coronavirus. John, for those of you who didn't revere him, maybe you can get introduced to him in the wake of all this trouble. He was something. He was a postman. He delivered the mail. He was a mailman in Maywood, and went on to, with his pals, Steve Goodman, Bonnie Kolak, and others who formed the genius gathering, the Brothers Holstein, that was the Earl of Old Town in its glory days. They went on to huge and justified, very justified fame. He was always a good guy too, John. Wrote a lot of songs. So what I'm going to do, and I'm going to end this show this way. I am going to ask my friend Dan Long to play the entire version of Hello in There. I think it's John's most moving song. He wrote it also when he was like 22 years old. And for someone to have that kind of understanding about aging and what it means and what is lost is just an astonishment. It's only about 4 minutes long, and so we'll listen to that song. Dan Long will put some commercials in there. And I will say right now, goodbye and good night to you, and take great care of yourself this coming week. So, here's John Prine.
living there. Well, it'd been years since the kids had grown a life of their own and left us alone. John and Linda live in Omaha. Joe is somewhere on the road. We lost Davy in the Korean War, and I still don't know what for. Don't matter anymore. You know that old trees just grow stronger, and old rivers grow wilder. Just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there. Oh. Sits and stares through the back door screen, and all the news just repeats itself like some forgotten dream that we've both seen. Someday I'll go and call up Rudy. We work together. What could I say if he asked what's new? Nothing what's with you. Nothing much to do. You know that old trees just grow stronger, and old rivers grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there. So if you're walking down the street sometime, spot some hollow ancient eyes, don't just